Today is Thursday, November 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president raises the number of military troops he'll send to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Republicans want strong borders, no crime, no chaos, and no caravans.
The man accused of gunning down congregants at a Pennsylvania synagogue has been indicted as the funerals continue. Turkey releases a report on what it says happened to a murdered Saudi Washington Post contributor. And singer Drake out with a new song. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that the number of military troops deployed to the U.S.-Mexico border could reach 15,000, roughly triple the number the Pentagon said it currently plans for, a mission whose dimensions are shifting daily.
We have about 5,008. We'll go up to anywhere between 10 and 15,000 military personnel on top of Border Patrol, ICE, and everybody else at the border.
The troop numbers have been changing at a dizzying pace, and with Trump drawing a hard line on immigration in the lead up to the midterm elections, now less than a week away, Trump rejecting the idea that he was fear-mongering or using the issue for political purposes. Trump railed against illegal immigration, including several caravans of migrants from Central America slowly moving toward the U.S. border. The caravan of an estimated 4,000 people is still nearly 1,600 kilometers from the border. He also has promised to end so-called catch-and-release policies by erecting tent cities to hold those crossing illegally.
Oh, they'll be here fast. They're trying to get up any way they can. They're trying to get up by train. They're trying to get up by truck and by buses. We're going to be prepared. They're not coming into our country.
The president also this week is asserting that he would act or could act by executive order to unilaterally end birthright citizenship for the children of non-U.S. citizens. That's a law that automatically makes babies born in America United States citizens. Well, joining us now to discuss this and all of it, Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Let's first talk about the military being sent to the U.S.-Mexico border. In your view, is this needed and is it a good use of our resources?
There's a law called Posse Comitatus, a statute passed by Congress. What the statute effectively says is military troops cannot serve in a police function in this country. Trump is not going to use the military in a police capacity, but as sort of backup. And I think what he's doing is he's trying to intimidate with numbers.
15,000 military troops for unarmed migrants? That apparently is more troops than we have in Afghanistan and Syria combined.
Yeah, I think that's right.
What is going on here? Is this necessary?
Of course we don't. But this is part of the Trump regimen where you're blustering along and I'll show them, I'm going to send 15,000 troops down there as a means of intimidation. That's what I think is going on.
But we already have Border Patrol, right?
Yep.
Are they not capable of doing that? Or,
Of course they are. These are people who've traveled from, you know, Honduras, Guatemala, and so forth. What is that trek, about 1,000 miles?
Mm-hmm.
They're exhausted. They have little kids with them. They're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
They're exposed to the elements. This is not going to take green berets in order to keep them from entering the United States.
It's true. The president, you're describing what types of people these are. But the president, in his latest comments, said that there are some very bad people and thugs and criminals,
yeah,
and they're dangerous.
And
I'm sorry?
And Middle Easterners.
Correct. He has said that as well. Is that just sort of to inspire fear? My understanding is these people are fleeing violence. I mean, they're walking to get away from violence.
According to the newspapers, some number have turned back. They're exhausted. They just can't make it. I think that this is intended to intimidate, and this is less than a week to the elections.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is in large measure a gesture to his people. Now, look, I told you when I was running for office that I would stop this immigration, and that's what I'm doing. If the Democrats would cooperate, I'd have a wall by now. And I think this is designed to, you know, to get his people listening to this kind of talk, saying, yeah, yeah, that's right. Why don't we, you know, use our army and kick these folks back to Honduras or Guatemala? It's incredibly mean-spirited, of course.
What does it say? What kind of message does it send to the world that the United States of America literally tell people, don't come here, we're not letting you in? He
right.
did say that as well in those remarks, that yep. they're not coming in.
Look, I find it repulsive. I think it is so mean-spirited, and it really doesn't represent the best in America. If you recall, after the Hungarian revolt in 1956, the U.S. accepted lots of Hungarians just because it was the right thing to do. In Czechoslovakia in 1968, same thing. We took in many Czechs, and to turn people back, I just think is so unfair and mean-spirited. It does not represent, in my view, the best of America.
The president and his strong immigration policies is now saying that he wants to get rid of the birthright. People that are born in the United States, children, babies of migrants that are born in the United States, that they are would no longer be allowed to automatically be citizens. He says he has the right to change that, but my understanding is that the president does not have the ability to override the Constitution. This is the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. Does the president have the authority to overturn this?
He does not. And in my view, it's not even arguable. I heard on a news broadcast this afternoon, mid-afternoon, that the president said that many great legal scholars support him. I would love it if you mentioned one. This is such an obvious thing. I mean, how could an executive order, not even a piece of legislation, but an executive order, overturn the Constitution of a country? And the answer, of course, is it can't. Again, this is, I think, playing to his base. Yeah, we don't want any more of those darned immigrants coming in here. They're taking all our good jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And this is a way of getting his people fired up before the election, in my estimation.
Okay.
There's one more thing there, though. The 14th Amendment is part of the three civil rights, so-called civil rights amendments. 13 eliminated slavery.
Mm-hmm.
14 is what we're just talking about. 15 was voting. This is not an insignificant amendment. This particular issue, I think, probably is, although it is explicitly stated in the amendment. But what it is really designed to do is make sure that all citizens in any state receive due process of law and equal protection of the law. The 14th Amendment is an enormously important provision. And to have a president come in and sort of cavalierly say, yeah, I can get rid of it, no problem. I don't know what possible legal theory, no matter how unclear, I don't know how one could possibly argue his position.
That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. The suspect in the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre was indicted by a federal grand jury Wednesday, and members of a grief-stricken Jewish community endured another round of funerals for the victims of the worst anti-Semitic attack in American history. AP correspondent Warren Levinson has more.
A federal grand jury indicted Robert Bowers on 44 counts, including hate crimes. Bowers is being held without bail and is scheduled for a preliminary hearing Thursday. The indictment was expected. Prosecutors have indicated they'll seek to have Bowers put to death. Today begins the process of seeking justice for the victims of these hateful acts, U.S. Attorney Scott Brady said. The indictment came as three more funerals were held. Bowers is accused of killing 11 people and wounding six Saturday at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue. The two victims still hospitalized remain in intensive care, but are improving, says the chairman of emergency medicine. I'm Warren Levinson.
Well, the indictment was announced on the second day of a week-long series of funerals for congregants who perished. The Squirrel Hill neighborhood of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, was also home to a beloved television personality, musician, puppeteer, and minister. Fred Rogers was an American known as the creator, composer, producer, writer, showrunner, and host of the preschool television series Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And he lived just blocks away from where the synagogue massacre took place. Rogers died in 2003, and he was known for teaching children to be kind, honor diversity, and to welcome their neighbors. Here's a bit of his theme song.
I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you.
And while Mr. Rogers is gone, his message is living on in the Fred Rogers Center. Joining us now to talk more about his legacy and how it this has impacted the community. Joining us now is Roberta Schomburg, Executive Director of the Center.
I think the way the community has come together, it really brought joy to my heart to see the outpouring of care and compassion and the way people outside of Squirrel Hill came to support the community. And I think some of that comes from the sense of community that inspired Fred Rogers and what he was often talking about when he was communicating to children about being a good neighbor and reaching out to help others and the kindness that he saw in everyone. I mean, one of the things he loved about Squirrel Hill was the sense of diversity. He said he could walk down the street and hear Yiddish and Hebrew and a dozen other languages, and people were so very accepting of one another. And I think Mr. Rogers, like part of his legacy, is the influence that the television program had on the whole community, not just children.
What do you think he would say if he were alive and still here to witness what has happened in his neighborhood?
One of the things that he often said was that when there were times of crisis, when he was a child, his mother would say, "Look for the helpers." And so one of the things he would then say is, "My mother always told me to look for the helpers, and that's what we have to help children do. That's what we have to do ourselves. We have to look at the good." Another thing that he said was that in every neighborhood all across the country, there are good people who are trying to make a good start for the young. So we have to hold those people up and as examples and talk about the ways that people are working for good. And so with his helper's message, I think one of the things he always said was look for the people who are helping to make it right and not get so focused or distracted by the terrible things that people have done.
Unbelievable, really, that he was so respectful of diversity and all that it brings to understanding one another. And it's such a terrible irony, though, that this happened in his own neighborhood. What would he say to children about something like this? How would he explain to them how something like this could have happened?
I think one of the things he would say is we have to listen to the children, and rather than make assumptions about what they know, what they don't know, what they saw, what they didn't see, so that we can be responsive. And some children may interact in very different ways or respond in very different ways. And so it's important, I think, for the adults to not be judgmental about how the children are feeling. If some children don't seem to react, it may just take some time for them to respond. If other children react by being angry, we have to help children know that it's okay to have those feelings, but what they do with that anger matters. And that we have to channel that anger into something good, into some way of helping other people, rather than allowing the anger to just fester and infect all of our interactions.
Fred Rogers also, in times of crisis, had advice for the media and, of course, for people watching the media. And there has been a lot of rhetoric in recent months about the media, negative media. What advice would he give the media?
One of the things he also said was, we have to make goodness look attractive. And we do that by the way we reach out to other people, to our neighbors, and how we encourage others rather than being demeaning and hateful. And so one of the things I think he would say is that we need to pay attention to what we're showing on the media. But beyond that, I think one of the cautions that we have to take into consideration is that when children see these events over and over and over again, they sometimes think they're multiple events rather than just one event that's being reshown. Mm. And so we often say to families, you know, pay attention to how much the children are seeing so that they don't think this is something that is still going on today, even though it was on Saturday. Mm. If they see the video, they may think it happened. Oh my gosh, it happened again. So I think some of those things we need to be careful of. And then I think looking for ways, you know, one of the things that the media could do would be to find ways that people are reaching out. And that's what we saw this weekend when we saw all of the people coming together and singing and praying and supporting their community. And those are the kinds of things I think we have to be sure that on the media we show those, as well as the more sensational things.
Have you all been involved at all in any sort of support efforts with the community following this tragedy?
We have been talking with some of the people in the communities, and the Fred Rogers Center is actually working with the University of Pittsburgh to have a symposium next week at Rodef Shalom Synagogue, which is where the first funeral was this week. And we're going to be pulling people together and talking about what we can do, particularly with young children in the preschool programs there. I think we feel that people need a chance to talk. So I'll be moderating a panel that will focus on how do we support children and families in times of crisis.
That's Roberta Schomburg, Executive Director of the Fred Rogers Center.
You know, my mother used to say a long time ago, whenever there would be any really catastrophe that was in the movies or on the air, she would say, always look for the helpers. There will always be helpers, you know, even just on the sidelines. That's why I think that if news programs could make a conscious effort of showing rescue teams, of showing who medical people, anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy, to be sure that they include that. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Well, here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A homeschool in Yemen educates hundreds of children. North Korea readies nuclear missile sites for international inspectors. African investigative journalists say threats are mounting from near and far. And the UN welcomes moves to restart negotiations on Western Sahara. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Calling the climate right, the U.S. Wednesday appealed for a ceasefire in Yemen and for the combatants to return to UN-backed peace talks to end more than 3 years of war. Author and former UN Security Council Yemen Panel of Experts member Gregory Johnson spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the timing of the effort.
There's a couple of different things that the U.S. is considering. One, of course, is the death of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist who was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. I think that's brought a lot of criticism down on Saudi Arabia, and in particular, Mohammed bin Salman. And the U.S. is seeing this, and Mohammed bin Salman's also the architect of the war in Yemen. I think the U.S. also realizes that there are impending congressional votes. I know Senator Sanders and others have talked about putting a vote that would basically halt U.S. supplies. So right now, the U.S. provides logistics, refueling, and intelligence to the Saudi-led coalition. And a number of senators on a bipartisan basis, both Republicans and Democrats, are looking to close that down, which would, in their mind at least, bring the Saudi campaign to a halt and alleviate what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
A U.S. source familiar with the issue, according to Reuters, said that one of the driving factors is progress made by UN Special Envoy for Yemen Martin Griffiths during a September visit to the Houthi-held capital Sana'a. That time, Houthi leaders expressed an interest in taking part in talks, and apparently the other side is also willing to do so.
Yeah, so in September, there was actually an attempt by Special Envoy Griffiths to get both sides to Geneva. What happened, though, is that the Houthis backed out, and there are different stories as to what exactly happened. The Saudis, of course, blame it on the Houthis. The Houthis, of course, blame it on the Saudis. But whatever the case, they were never able to have the talks about talks. And so what's happened over the last 24, 48 hours is that the United States, through the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, has put a lot of pressure both on Saudi Arabia as well as on the Houthis, and they've really given the Special Envoy, I think, the most cover, the most political cover that he's had in some time. And we have to remember, this is our third Special Envoy in the past 4 years in Yemen. None of them so far have been successful. And this might be the last best chance to bring about a peace.
Defense Secretary Mattis on Tuesday called for a ceasefire within 30 days, said the Saudis and UAE appear ready to embrace efforts by Griffiths to find the negotiated solution. Is the 30-day time frame feasible? Is it possible?
It's possible. I think we've seen ceasefires before in this. There was a long one in 2016 during the Obama administration. Then Secretary of State Kerry was very involved in the diplomacy going back and forth to a number of different players. So it's certainly something that can be done within 30 days. The problem is this is a war that's been going on for more than 4 years, and both sides, all sides really, continue to seem to think that they have more to be gained militarily than they do at the negotiating table. And when that's the case, it's really anybody's guess as to whether or not these talks can bring about something that is lasting and durable in Yemen.
In the U.S., on both political sides of the aisle, is there growing concern about the mounting civilian casualties in this conflict?
Absolutely. There was a vote earlier this year that was narrowly defeated. It was 55-45 that allowed the U.S. to continue to provide logistical support as well as some weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. And I think particularly over the last 4 weeks, and particularly in the aftermath of Jamal Khashoggi's murder in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, you've seen a even more of a growing consensus that something has to be done. Again, this is a war that's been going on for more than 4 years. The UN calls it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. I know myself, as someone who's traveled to the country and who's worked on Yemen for a long time, that it's a very, very dire situation. And it's not the Saudi leadership that's suffering. By and large, it's not the Houthi leadership that's suffering in this war. It's the Yemeni civilian population that's bearing the brunt of the war.
Gregory Johnson is a former UN Security Council Yemen Panel of Experts member. And even as thousands of coalition troops, he says, mass for a renewed assault on the Red Sea port of Hodeidah. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis Tuesday called for a ceasefire in 30 days, adding he believes the Saudis and United Arab Emirates seem ready to embrace UN efforts aimed at a negotiated settlement. A Turkish prosecutor says Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed by strangulation immediately after entering Riyadh's consulate in Istanbul before his body was cut into pieces. Reuters reporter Emily Wither has the story.
In a statement from the prosecutor, it says the planned killing saw the Saudi critic suffocated and then his body dismembered and disposed of. The announcement comes after 2 days of talks with Saudi Arabia's public prosecutor, who has been in Turkey as part of a joint investigation. The statement also said no concrete results were reached in those meetings. Khashoggi's death has escalated into a crisis for the kingdom, which at first denied any knowledge of or role in his disappearance.
Meanwhile, after months of absence in London, senior Saudi royal prince Ahmad bin Abdulaziz arrived back in Riyadh Tuesday, prompting conjecture that older members of the Gulf Kingdom's ruling family are ready to assert themselves in the wake of Khashoggi's death. Some London expats say Ahmad is likely to lead an effort to curtail the power of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, widely referred to as MBS, and argue for the appointment of a senior royal to act as a guardian for the Crown Prince. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Scientists are putting a robotic Mars rover to the test in Spain's rocky Tabernas Desert. The European Space Agency and Russia's Roscosmos Space Agency plan to land a rover on the Red Planet in 2021 to search for microscopic signs of life. Faith Lapidus reports.
This could be the surface of Mars. But it's not. It is the Tabernas Desert in southeastern Spain.
And that is why scientists are here, field testing a Mars rover prototype, nicknamed Charlie. After testing in a controlled laboratory setting, they needed to get as close as they could to the actual terrain.
You need to understand everything in isolation first. But then you go out into the real landscape. You've got wind. Of course Mars has wind. We just learned about the last dust storm. And you've got the sun moving around you. And you've got little gravels that move. And it's all more natural, more chaotic, more dangerous, and not as well as controlled as you are in a lab.
To simulate interacting with the rover when it is 54.5 million kilometers away on the Martian surface, scientists set up a remote control center about 1,600 kilometers north of the desert in Harwell, UK. From there, they sent Charlie rolling over the rocky terrain at a mind-boggling 3.5 centimeters a second.
It doesn't need to go anywhere fast. It needs to identify interesting places and ensure the security, the safety of the platform at all times. So you don't want to go anywhere fast, and because you might actually miss something really interesting.
If the ExoMars mission lands successfully in 2021, Charlie will be Europe's first rover on the red planet. What sets it apart from NASA's rovers is its ground-penetrating drill. The Martian atmosphere gives organic material little protection from the sun's radiation, so scientists believe below the surface is the best place to look for evidence of past or present life. The solar-powered rover will spend 7 months on that search. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Well, singing star of today joins a star from the past in a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details.
Today, it's a brand new song from one of the hottest R&B singers on the planet, Drake, from his new Scorpion album, which has streamed close to 1 billion times already. The new song features a deceased artist. In fact, this is not the first time that a hit song has been released by Michael Jackson, even after his 2009 death. This is the fourth posthumous hit for Michael Jackson. This one is with Drake, and the song is called Don't Matter to Me.
Hey, you know that's not the way to get over me.
All of a sudden, you said you don't want me to go.
That's an interesting combination, Drake and Michael Jackson.
Well, it is. In fact, the song originally was by Michael Jackson. Drake has given it new life on his Scorpion album. And Drake's had one heck of a big year, as we all know. He got the song of the summer with his last hit, In My Feelings. He's had 3 number one songs now off of his Scorpion album, which came out earlier this year. And that song, which was a song that Michael had recorded a number of years ago, is Michael's 30th top 10 overall hit, because the song debuted at number 9. Wow. Meanwhile, Drake himself broke a record set by the Beatles in 1964 this past year by having the most top 10 hits in 1 year with his 12th, and the Beatles' record was 11 for that feat. So congratulations to Drake on yet another big hit record. And also last week he turned 32. He had a big themed birthday party. It was a 2000s themed birthday party. Diddy was there, and quite a few other celebrities showed up for the birthday parties. And they all wore jerseys from sports heroes back in the decade, the 2000s, like Kobe Bryant with his Lakers jersey and some other things like that.
Where did it take place?
It took place in Los Angeles at some club. Now, Drake owns his own company, and it's called OVO, which stands for October's Very Own. And Drake's birthday is October 24th. So happy 32nd birthday to Drake. And congratulations on the new single, Don't Matter to Me.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.